I appreciate, Don, your message. There is passion in Texas. There is kingdom of God in Texas. The Spirit of God is alive and well in Texas as well as everywhere else. And I'm so excited to see what God is doing around the world. It is impressive. We have a brother here from Australia, I guess, today. And we were just down in Australia and New Zealand. There's a tremendous reformation of sorts going on in Australia and New Zealand as well. And we just we thank God that the Spirit of God is not completely departing from the Western world. I wrote a book on that called Apostate. It's a little bit discouraging first, but you got to get to the last chapter. That's the whole idea. So if you're going to commit to the book, you have to read all the way through page 285. Otherwise, don't bother. But let me talk about what's happened in our own family over the last couple of generations. We homeschool our children. Any of you homeschool your children anywhere in Texas or anywhere else in the world? That's what we've been doing for the last 42 years or so. My parents were homeschooling us back in the 60s and 70s, and I tell you, it has been a blessing. God has blessed our family tremendously. We had a family reunion again back in Oregon a couple, three, 4 weeks ago, and it was a blessed time. It was just a wonderful time. All six of my parents' children are serving God somewhere around the world. We have homeschooling moms. We have pastors, missionaries, elders in churches around the world. And God has really blessed our family in incredible ways. And I'm so happy that that in the second generation we've been homeschooling ourselves. And so I'm going to try to give you a bit of the vision that we have understood from the Word of God, and something that's come through the generations. My parents started to understand some things, and I think we're starting to understand some things, and I've shared this vision to probably 150,000 people around America over the last 12 years. And I would say that's a conservative number. Now, out of the 150,000 people that have heard my message, I would guess that barely 5% have captured it. And I wonder sometimes why that is the case. It's a little bit frustrating to me, I guess, sometimes, when I realize that very few in the homeschooling movement around America really get it. Now, God has given me the blessing of speaking to hundreds of thousands of people around America. I've probably been one of the top keynote speakers, by God's grace, over the last 5 or 6 or 7 years in homeschooling conferences in some 45 states around America. But I will tell you that very few, precious few people get it. Very few people get it. And this is sort of sad. I don't know the reason, but I think part of it is the fact that the Spirit of God has to move in order for people to really understand the battle. And I'm going to say that there is a battle in education. But let me begin with why we like to homeschool our own children out on the eastern plains of Colorado. And let me share some of those reasons with you right now. I've got 10 reasons. And they're personal reasons why we prefer to homeschool. And hopefully this will give you an insight, not only in ourselves, but also on my philosophy of education somewhat. I try to use pictures as much as possible. But here are 10 reasons why we like to homeschool, first of which is that we don't have to ask the school district for permission if we want to go hunting for 2 weeks in October. We just take off, and we take our children, and we shoot big animals. Do you do that in Texas? Does anybody do that? Okay, good. Okay, and that's, to me, just the freedom to not have to ask permission of a school district is a blessing. And that is one of the reasons why we like to homeschool. Second reason why we like to homeschool is that we can pray anytime we want to, which I think is a bonus. I think if there's limitations on that kind of thing, it just smacks of being unbiblical. To me. Now, granted, it's very hard to convince 95% of American Christians of that, but when Paul says to pray without ceasing, it seems to me that to pray anytime, that is to just stand up in the middle of a chemistry study or a study of biology and stand up, raise your hands and say, let's praise God, let's worship the creator of all of this. It seems to me that's a good thing to do. Now, my understanding is not many Christian kids do that in biology classrooms, in universities, in the state of Texas. And I say that's a crying shame, because I think that the creator of heaven and earth ought to be recognized from time to time. Does anybody else agree with me here? Okay, good. Good. And there are some who believe in God here. That's good. Okay, third reason why we like to homeschool is that our children can be in four grade levels at the same time. Now, I know people see that as a little bit odd. People come to my children from time to time and say, "Honey, you're homeschooled. Oh, that's wonderful. What grade are you in?" And they'll just give them that dumb look. Very embarrassing for a moment, because we're trying to defend the reputation of homeschoolers all over the world. And my children are giving this person a dumb look. So I've got to step in and say, "Ma'am, he's 10 years old. He's in Algebra 2. Please back off." Okay, so that's the third reason. Fourth reason why we like to homeschool is that as a homeschool graduate, I can have a class reunion anytime I want to. So it's good. Just a benefit. And then another reason why we like to homeschool is that we just prefer pajamas to school uniforms ourselves. It's a preference. Another reason is that we have never missed the bus, which is convenient. My children like to wave at the bus, the school bus. Does the school bus ever come by your property or your house? My children like to run out and wave at the school bus as it goes by. They call it the jail bus. And they've tried to release the inmates from time to time. It's embarrassing when they do that. But we try to stop that as much as possible. Okay, another reason, I think I've already alluded to this, but another reason why we like to homeschool our children out in the eastern plains of Colorado is, which by the way is northern Texas. So if anybody knows about northern Texas, I come from northern Texas, way up there. It's north of here, about 1,000 miles or so. Texas is very big, I think is my point. And so we come from northern Texas, and out where we are, our children like to bring guns to school with them. So that's another reason why. My son has always felt like he studied better with his .22 leaned up against his desk. And oh, it's okay, you know, that was okay with us. And you can't do that in the public schools here in Texas. They frown on that. Okay. Another reason why we like to homeschool our children is that there's always somebody to take out the trash. And the final reason why we like to homeschool our children is that the school staff is in love with each other. And we kiss and make out in front of the class. So. And you cannot do that in the public schools. Okay. Just want to make sure we're all on board here. So these are the reasons why we like to homeschool. But back in the 1990s, let me give you some personal testimony here. Back in the 1990s, my wife did most of the homeschooling. That's because we were Aquinas-oriented, we were dualists. And I might get into this a little bit later, but probably not in this presentation, but my wife is responsible for the homeschooling. Now, is that true generally in the homeschooling movement in Texas? Is that true generally here, where the wife typically does about 80 to 90% of the schoolwork? And that's kind of the way we were. And I don't know about any of the ladies here, but my wife would often get stressed out about it. And I could never understand this, because I would go to work in the corporate world, and I would work very, very hard, and I would come home, and my wife is stressing out. She's still in her pajamas, and I'm not going to ask her about that, and I'm not going to ask her what's for dinner tonight. You know, it's one of those deals. Has anybody here ever stressed out about homeschooling their kids? About four of you? You're kidding me. That's it? My wife would be so stressed out about homeschooling. She's still a little stressed out. There be times, you know, we can be a little irrational at 11:30 at night. I don't know if any of you have ever been a little irrational, but my wife will wake up and shoot up and say, "I think we're failing with educating Abigail." You know, she'll be like vibrating like this. And I'm at the point now where I'm saying, and I'm fine with that, let's just go to sleep. Let's get some sleep now. So I'm over concerns concerning that. But my wife is really very, very concerned about how things are going to work out. And at points in the 1990s, the later 90s, she would say, "I can't do this anymore. I think I'm just going to have to quit." And this is where reality came through. And I was working as executive director of Christian Home Educators of Colorado. So I would, of course, turn back to her and say, "We can't quit, honey. I'm executive director of CHEC, you know, and I'm traveling around the nation talking about homeschooling. Hey, we can't quit." She would say, "Can we move, change our names and move to Kansas, you know?" It'd be one of those moments, you know, that wasn't going well. And she was getting a little bit of pushback from my son as well, my oldest son. And a part of it was the fact that my son was surrounded by five women most of the time. So that was an issue, I think. And another part of the reason is that sons are not supposed to be schooled and discipled by their mother indefinitely. Does everybody understand this? Boys are not to be discipled and schooled by their mothers indefinitely. And so this was coming home to me, but I was very busy with other things. And so I would encourage my wife to continue in the process of homeschooling my son, who at the time was 11 or 12 years of age. And finally, she came back to me and said, I can't do this anymore. She says, you've been talking about homeschooling all over the country for the last 3 years. How would you like to try it? And I said, sounds like fun. I'll give it a shot. And I've been homeschooling my son ever since. He's graduated now, and he still works with me, and it's a blessing to have him with us even on this weekend. But here's the deal about homeschooling. It is stressful. I stress out about it. It's because my children are in my life, and suddenly I realize I'm responsible. I remember getting a brochure from a private Christian school that came to our house maybe about 10 years ago in the midst of all of this. And this is what I read. Listen to this. This is a brochure from a Christian school. And you know this guy knew what he was talking about. He had a PhD, an EDD, an FDD, a GDD. He had a lot of DDs. He had at least six. So you know he was smart. And so this really, really smart guy was writing on education. He says, there's a misjudgment among some circles that a teacher does not need to be university trained or carry the appropriate credentials. Unqualified persons should not perform brain surgery. So there it is, right there. So what do you think? See, what is he saying? He's saying, education is a very high-tech affair. Whatever you do, don't try this at home. Do not try this at home. There are professionals who've been very carefully trained, and yet, friends, you know and I know that the data has always pointed out something very different. That's what made the homeschooling movement so interesting. I mean, here was a brand new movement that really isn't brand new, but it's come back into the modern world to the tune of 2 to 3 million students doing it. And I think with the second generation, we're going to pop up to 5 to 6 million by the year 2020. This thing's not over. But here's the deal. In the last 30 years, we have had a resurgence of parents doing it. Now we have a contrast between how the professionals are doing and how the rinky-dink moms and dads are doing things in their homeschools and the kitchens and living rooms around America. And the statistic that blows the minds, I'm not going to give you all the Brian Ray stuff, but the statistic, I still look at this thing and I go, whoa, dude, is the statistic you're going to see on the screen right now. And it is the comparison between, this is the academic results, between the moms and dads who homeschool without a parental certification versus those that homeschool with a parental certification. And what you find is that there is zero, zilch, nothing, no statistically significant difference whatsoever in the performance of their kids. And you see it for the eighth grade, it looks like the non-certified parent's doing slightly better than the professional certified parent. And yet, doesn't it blow your mind that 95% of public school administrators say, any form of education is better than homeschooling. Don't you dare try it. Is that amazing to you? I mean, is that all amazing to you? Is that like step back? Ooh, wow, that's incredible. The fact of the matter is, we're concerned about education. I think everybody is. Everybody is. And anybody who's got a brain and is concerned about the future seems to place a huge emphasis on education. So it doesn't matter who it is. For instance, I'll give you some examples. Atheists consider education to be very important. There was an atheist that visited Ken Ham's Creation Museum a couple of years ago, and I'll never forget the article Ken Ham wrote. I mean, here's the atheists. Okay, for the most part, evolution dominates everywhere. Right? For the most part, it's like millions and millions and billions of dollars are spent trying to sell the Emperor's New Clothes program to everybody that somehow a rock turned into a human being over 4 billion years by total absolute chance. We have no mechanism. We have no idea how it happened. We have no data. We have no transitional fossils. We've never repeated in a laboratory. And we know that the odds are 1 in 10 to the 5,000, which is way, way more than every single atom in the entire universe. And we think that in 4 billion years, over about 5,000 generations, a rock turned into a human being by total and absolute chance. Trust us on this one. We have a PhD, and we've got $6 trillion selling it to you. And most Americans buy it. They're out of their minds. Do you understand? They're out of their minds. And they buy it. But there's one little guy standing up in the whole Emperor's New Clothes Maker procession. And he's saying, I think the dude's nude. And everybody's saying, would somebody shut him up? Just shut him up. Because the two-year-old has the courage, the faith, the vision to stand up and say, that's truth, that's not. So Ken Ham's doing that. Ken Ham's the proverbial two-year-old, okay? And so this atheist shows up and he's like, oh no, there's one museum in the world. In a world of 50,000 museums, there's one that speaks the truth. And they're freaking out about it. And then he says this on the blog. We are in a battle over the hearts and the minds of the next generation. And I said, I think he's right. It's just that I wish that other Christians would agree with us. You know, me and the atheist. We are in a battle over the hearts and the minds of the next generation. The only thing is, the atheist is on the other side. All right, here's the other reason why education is important. Because what do you do if you ruin a batch of cookies? I mean, you burn them black, crisp, done. You know, just they're toast, black toast. You pull them out of the oven. What do you do if you ruin a batch of cookies? You throw them out. What do you do if you ruin a batch of kids? Does everybody follow me here? Because here's the deal, and I think every one of us would wish that we could have a practice run on the raising children area of life, don't we? I mean, couldn't we just, like, have a practice run, kind of ruin things, and then we'll do it again, and we'll do it right the second time. Unfortunately, it doesn't work that way. You get one shot at raising your kids, and I think every parent deep down knows that is important. Or maybe some have confused themselves away from that, but I think everybody knows it's important. And it's important because, you know what? You can ruin your children. We all have the technology. We can do it. We can ruin our kids. And people do it all the time. This is the battle of the last 200 years. And that's why I deal with an apostate. I'm amazed at the apostasy of the Western world. And I found that the greatest men who accomplished the greatest feats for all of the issues of darkness that have brought about hundreds of millions of dead bodies, the tyrannies and everything else of the last 200 years, and those that have done everything they can to set a trajectory against the Christian faith to kill Christ and all of the memories of Christ of the last 1900 years, almost every one of them, without exception, that I have covered in my book, and these are the most powerful Nephilim, the most powerful influencers of the modern world, every one of them were raised in a Christian household or with Christian generations that dated back 8, 9, 10 generations. Some of them, like John Paul Sartre, had 6 to 7 generations of Protestant pastors in their background, and they became the most amazing, the most powerful apostates of the modern age. And I think of John Dewey, who was raised... John Dewey raised in a Christian household. His mother was an evangelical Calvinist who would ask everybody, do you know Jesus? And John Dewey went to college. And in college, over a period of time, especially when he was writing his first books, he was shamed out of the Christian faith by his instructor at Johns Hopkins University, G. Stanley Hall. G. Stanley Hall, of course, the most outstanding racist, eugenicist, eliminate the bad species, you know, kill as many people as possible in order to, you know, get rid of the blacks, get rid of the man who is the first major psychologist in American history, the man who was a brain child behind the modern public schools, G. Stanley Hall. He was raised in a Christian household, a nice little farm family as well. His parents didn't want him to go to college. They finally convinced him, I'll go and I'll learn to be a pastor. He said, oh, okay, you can go to college. And of course he lost his faith. That's what happens. When you go to the big universities in the 1800s, of course you lose your faith. He went off to Germany and lost even more faith, and then he was gone. He was a total, full-blown apostate and shamed John Dewey out of the Christian faith. And this has happened again and again and again and again. I can tell you, people are homeschooled, Christian schooled, relatives raised in missionary families. Their young men take their liberal arts, the literature curriculum very, very, very seriously. They wind up in liberal arts college. And to this day, they are now some of the most pro-socialist, pro-atheist, pro-communist professors in America today. And I can tell you they come from homeschool families, they come from Christian families. I don't know how many times we want to make this mistake, but families make it all the time. And generally speaking, the odds are very much in favor of the other side. If you send them to Wheaton College, remember that these Christian colleges like Wheaton College, the majority of the professors vote for Barack Obama. Yes, I know Philip Ryken is the president. Yes, 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 I know he's PCN reformed. I'm telling you that the Christian liberal arts universities, generally speaking, are very, very liberal. Why? Because they do not engage the battle in the classroom as they really ought to. And I heard a story of a classical school down in San Diego where over a period of time, nice little homeschooling families were told, hey, there's a nice little classical school. Everybody ought to do it. And they started sending their kids to this school in the 1990s, early 2000s. And as the years have gone by, the majority of them are walking away from the faith. They're turning into liberals and socialists and humanists and attending the worst liberal arts universities. And so it goes. Does it really matter where you send your kids? Why is America abandoning the faith? Why was there a sin in the 1700s for which people were executed? There was capital punishment. And today, if you speak against that particular sin, you very well might be arrested, certainly in Canada and England. We've seen that happen a couple of times, and soon in America as well. Why? Why are people pushing the Neuronic agenda so hard in Christian countries when the last few pagan countries like Africa are pushing back on the Neuronic agenda or the homosexual marriage thing that was concocted by Nero, the worst man who ever lived in the history of the world, according to pagans and Christians alike? Nobody really disagrees on that. Why? Why do Christians today embrace this agenda with everything in it? Why is there a conservative Roman Catholic who is now coming out publicly and embracing homosexual marriage because he says Aquinas doesn't really draw a distinction between biblical law and natural law, or draws a distinction between biblical law and natural law, and natural law allows for these sorts of things to happen? The bounds of natural law move constantly when you buy into the Aquinas agenda. Why is America moving towards a liberal agenda that destroys the faith, that destroys freedom, and will put pastors in prison in Texas in the year 2020? Why? Why? Because American parents choose the wrong curriculum, the wrong education methodology, and the wrong universities for their kids. Period. And there's no sense in fighting other battles if you will not fight this battle. Friends, we're talking about battle. Why is my wife so stressed out? Because she's in battle. This is D-Day in the War of the Worldviews. This is Omaha Beach on D-Day in the War of the Worldviews. This is it, friends. We have made it. We are here. Yes, there is a battle. Yes, the atheist is right. Yes, they already know that the battle is here. And unless we engage the battle in education, you will lose your children, your nation, your freedoms, the Christian faith, Christian churches. Yes, you will. Again and again and again and again. It's been proven 100 times, 1,000 times in our recent history. We are in a significant battle. Therefore, you want to do this right. You want to do this right. And in any given homeschooling conference, there's 100 different approaches to take on this. That's why it's complicated. It's challenging. In fact, in many ways, the homeschooling conference is just 100 theories. on how to educate a child. Now, there's some that I would say operate within the bands of Christian liberty, and that's why it's good that there's liberty, but God's law lays out the standard for how we educate children, and I would commend to you this book. If you're dealing with something important, okay? I mean, if it comes to the point where you're saying, I think I'm in a very important area, I can't make a mistake, it's very important that I get this right. If you've ever come to that conclusion in your mind, may I suggest this book to you? This is called the Bible. And I got to the point where I was rather confused in homeschooling conferences. And so I said, let me go to the Bible and look up education in the concordance. And I could not find it in the concordance of my Bible. But I expanded the search to knowledge, wisdom, and understanding. And is it appropriate to say that education is giving knowledge, wisdom, and understanding to a young man or a young woman? Is that fair? Can we all agree on that? Okay, I think everybody, you know, if you go into a place that says that they're a school or they're into education, you say, do you give knowledge, wisdom, understanding to a young man or a young woman? And they say, yes, we do, then we're talking the same thing. If they say, no, we just changed tires here, then they're probably big O tires. Okay, so I'm just making this very, very simple for you. Very, very, very simple. Does the Bible have anything in the world to say about the giving of knowledge, wisdom, understanding to a young man or to a young woman? Does the Bible have anything to say about that? And it turns out that it does. Now, see, that's number one. That was a shocker to me. Shocker. Because I was raised in a typical evangelical / somewhat Reformed Baptist-y home, and which I would say would be a fairly conservative Christian home. Wouldn't you agree? And I never really thought the Bible had anything to say about anything useful. You know, I mean, the Bible is about us getting saved, pie in the sky, by and by. That's what I heard. That's what I thought. Because that's what most Christians think, right? That's what you think. Most Christians don't go, I wonder what the Bible has to say about taxes. Right? How many people have you ever run into? You say, what does the Bible have to say about taxes? The Bible doesn't have anything to say about anything useful. So, as it turns out, the Bible does. So, I wound up in one book of the Bible like 94% of the time. Guess what that book is? The book of Proverbs. Wait a minute. You guys have been to this presentation before? It's the book of Proverbs. The book of Proverbs. The book of Proverbs. I was amazed. There's a book in the Bible about education. And most Christian teaching colleges don't teach their teachers to memorize the book of Proverbs. They don't even use it much. But it's very, very helpful. And the reason is this: because God is very smart. He's very smart. I know people come back, yeah, not smarter than John Dewey, or Jean-Jacques Rousseau, or Thomas Mann. God is really smart. God made us. God knows us. God knows how to raise the next generation. And he uses the book of Proverbs as his means. Now, see, again, people get a little uptight about this in many conferences because I didn't come to this conference to hear the religious stuff. I'm trying to figure out if my kid is right-brained or left-brained. I'm trying to figure out how to educate a child, and I need a psychologist, I need a psychiatrist, I need an expert, I need a professional with a PhD, EdD, FdD, GED. I don't need some dumb preacher coming in and throwing God's word at me. Sick of it. I'm out of here. God's word speaks to real life. And yes, the book of Proverbs does not contain the Pythagorean theorem. And that has been a huge disappointment to a lot of people attending homeschool conferences. Huge! Like, God forgot the Pythagorean theorem. That's an A squared plus B squared plus C squared. I mean, you can't, you know, it's so important. Why would he give us a curriculum and forget to mention the Pythagorean theorem? The reason, of course, is that the Pythagorean theorem is not all that important. And this is where the little eighth grade boy goes, yes. I'm so glad we came here. Let's take notes. Somebody get some paper out. This guy's good. No. But that's really the case. You know, God's boiling things down. He does that in His Word. He boils it down to the basics. And here's what happened to us. What happened to us was we realized we were so focused on algebra and teaching geometry that we were forgetting the book of Proverbs. Has anybody ever committed that sin where you have focused so much on Saxon math that you were not doing the book of Proverbs, and your children actually knew Saxon math better than Proverbs? Anybody else besides me? There's about five of you. Okay, good. That was the way we were. And here's the kicker. We could not find curriculum on the book of Proverbs, every verse. We couldn't find it anywhere. And so that's why I put together our Proverbs study guides. I got three of them I put together over a period of about 5 years for my children. And we worked through all of that. And now we have a little workbook they can fill out, because my view of curriculum is not the Aquinas form where dad does the spiritual stuff and then mom does all of the secular stuff, you know, later on in the day. Which is the way education has been since Thomas Aquinas says there's a difference between sacred knowledge and philosophical knowledge built up on human reason, okay? And so this is the mentality of most American Christians. Let's get some Sunday school teachers in here. We'll get our pastors in here. And if we're family integrated, maybe dad. And we'll teach them the Word of God and the spiritual stuff. And later on, we'll deal with all that secular stuff, you know. And there's this line of segregation. So what we've done is we have dad say, hey, let's teach the Word of God as the core curriculum. And then we have workbooks that mom does with the kids later on in the day that ties directly in to what dad was doing with the children in the family worship. Does that make sense? We're trying to revolutionize the idea of curriculum for the K-6 student early on in their lives. We have to find a way to do this. Otherwise, it's just going to be another 1,000 years of Aquinas. And to be honest with you, I'm sick of it. I don't want to make this mistake forever and ever. So the book of Proverbs is largely about character. And that's a shocker, because people thought it was about geography, geometry, and geology. But here's the way I put it. If the raising of a child is like the building of a building, the foundation, the studs, and the drywall of an education for a child is faith and character for the child. That's the 724 job. You say, well, what is geometry, geology, and geography? It's the wall hangings. It's the wallpaper. It makes the place livable. But imagine this. Imagine putting wallpaper on walls that didn't exist. Try it sometime. Put wallpaper on walls that don't exist. All day long. This is called public school education. It's an exercise in futility. And they get paid $65,000 a year to do it. It's amazing. And for some reason, 80% of young men aren't grown up by 30 years of age, up from 30% in 1970. There's no character left in the nation. And among the millennial generation, 61% of households are fed by the mom as the major breadwinner, and 17% by men. And society is dying all around us. Character is dying, et cetera, et cetera. They go, what's going on? I can't figure this out. The whole thing's coming down. I can't figure it all out. May I suggest to you the book of Proverbs might be a really good place to start, because character is preeminent in the education of a child. It flows. This is not a 15-minute character first program on Friday afternoon when a nice little Christian godly person slips in and says, here's a little post-it note of character. Hope that helps for you. No, it's a 724 endeavor. Character is a 724 endeavor in the raising of a child, and we do not separate these things. My son was doing fairly well in math for a while, and then we noticed that at 12 or 13 years of age, there was 2 years ahead, but he was doing poorly on the tests, 75-80%. And I came up with this idea where he would do 4 to 5 lessons, and if he got less than 85% on the test, he'd have to redo all the 4 to 5 lessons all over again. And he said, well, Dad, that sounds like a pretty good idea, until we tried it. And he got 72% on the first test, and you know, there I'm grading the test. And some people say, math is not emotional. Well, I was getting emotional because I could tell, you know, the bottom lip was quivering a little bit, you know, that kind of thing. Anybody ever hear any of that ever in your homeschool? Yeah, okay, there's a lot of emotion involved, and you can't separate emotional and spiritual nature from the academic. Okay, we don't separate any of that. So I come back to my son. Son, you got 72%. You got to redo all the 4 to 5 lessons. He says, Dad, I already know this stuff. Why do I have to redo all 475 questions all over again? I said, son, I'm not trying to teach you math. I'm trying to teach you character. I'm just using math to do it. You see, what am I all about? What am I all about? What am I focused on? What matters? Does math matter? Character matters. The reason bridges come down is because somebody forgot to put a decimal point somewhere, and when you miss it on a test, you do your whole long program, and you miss it on a test, and you've got the decimal point in the wrong place, and you lose the whole question. Even after 15 minutes of work, you don't get extra credit. Why? Because the slothful man does not cut all the meat out that he's taken hunting, and if your child has a hard time with a meticulousness in his work, it is because of slothfulness. It's one of the 100 forms of slothfulness discussed in Proverbs, and you should be able to identify it as you grade their math. Why? Because you are focused. You are focused that you are focused on what? Factoring trinomials? No. 100 no's. Your focus is their slothfulness, their lack of faith and trust in God, their lack of honor to mother, their pushback, their scoffing attitude towards correction that has ever happened as you correct a math program. Ever. 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 Have you ever had any pushback? Anybody ever had any pushback, any scoffing as you're pointing out any errors or any areas in which they might improve? You know what I'm talking about, don't you? Character is preeminent in the education of a child. When Thomas Stanley wrote his book, Dr. Stanley wrote a book on the millionaires in America, it was a shock to me as I was reading this. I don't know if anybody else has ever brought this out, but I brought it out many, many times because he's asking these 721 millionaires in America what is it that contributed to your success in the somewhat free marketplace of the United States. Not all free market, but there's enough free market to reward some and not reward others. And so, you know, he's looking at these guys in their success. And it turns out that those people came back on the survey and said, I got a PhD in chemistry. I got straight A's all the way through college. 3.96 at the end. Those guys turned out at the very, very bottom of the list. That factor was like 26. But the number one most important factor for millionaires in providing their success in the American free marketplace was what? Tell the truth was number one. Tell the truth. And so, you know, this is a shocker to me because I did a series on the book of Proverbs, and I was prioritizing, Paretoization is what we call it, where I was charting out what lesson God is driving home more than any other lesson in the book of Proverbs, again and again and again and again. Turns out, number one, most repeated lesson in the book of Proverbs is the use of the tongue and tell the truth. Isn't that amazing? It shows up number one on this list for these millionaires who learn somehow you've got to tell the truth. As you engage in the free marketplace, you've got to tell the truth. Number two was hard work, which also shows up in where? Proverbs, yeah. Self-discipline was number three. That's also in the book of Proverbs, right? And then we have getting along with others. It's number four, and that shows up every other minute in the home school with mom trying to work it out with everybody. But also in the book of Proverbs. Number five blew my mind on this list. I mean, I'm looking at this list, this statistical list from millionaires in America. Now, these aren't done very much because nobody really wants to hear the truth. But occasionally somebody will actually tell the truth of what's going on out there, really going on out there. Number five for millionaires was get a supportive spouse. I'm thinking to myself, wow, that's like deja vu. I remember that from somewhere. Let's see, supportive spouse. Where did that show up? In the book of Proverbs. Oh, yeah, there it is. Proverbs 31. After 30 chapters of dad engaging in the paideia of the child, mom shows up, says, okay, I have one thing to say. You've got to get a supportive spouse, son. Her price is far above rubies, and this is what she looks like. And as I'm reading this, I'm thinking, wow, what God has learned from millionaires. Incredible. I'm testing your epistemological authority just for a second there. I'm hoping some of you are saying, no, wait a minute, maybe the millionaires picked it up from God somewhere along the line. Okay, character, preeminent education of a child. It flows. It flows, it flows, it flows. Number two, principle of individuality. This is the principle of Christian liberty. And it's all based on the assumption that you make when you have your second child, and you say, they pop out of the womb, and the first thing you say is, wow, they're so different. You know, like it's a big revelation. Oh, they're so different. Oh, I just can't believe how different they are. And then you have your third child, and it's like, no-brainer. Of course they're different. I mean, come on, anybody knows that. But here's the problem. Here's the problem. What you get after Laura Ingalls Wilder, who, by the way, America became a very strong nation, a blessed nation, probably the strongest nation on earth on one-room schoolhouses and homeschools, okay? You didn't have these big, big Rousseauian institutional buildings until the turn of the 20th century. You had Laura Ingalls Wilder showing up with six students and saying, good morning, class. Where'd you leave off last year? That's what the way they start every year. Where'd you leave off last year? And the 10-year-old would say, ma'am, I was halfway through the fourth reader. And the 12-year-old would say, I just started the third reader. And the 9-year-old said, ma'am, I think I just started the first reader. And she said, great, well, let's just keep going. And that's what they did for 5,900 years until the expert showed up. And when the expert showed up, the expert said, let's centralize control over whole of America. Well, first start with school districts, because we got to get somebody to boss around Laura Ingalls Wilder and every homeschooling mom out there. And then we'll centralize control on State Department's education. Then we'll centralize control over the whole United States with Bill Bennett and the U.S. Department of Education. And then we'll do worldwide standards. And then we'll get Common Core. And then we'll triple the size. And George W. Bush, you know, triple the size of the budget of the Department of Education just to make sure that everything was centralizing and standardizing. Just to be sure that there were standardized tests you could teach to so that nobody would learn anything. And by the way, I am bipartisan when I say that I criticize everybody. I think Republicans and Democrats have it very badly. They have no idea what the principle of individuality is. The principle of individuality is to look at my kid and say, what grade are you in? And for them to respond with a dumb look. You don't know the grade I'm in. I'm 10 years old. Does that help you? We have not a cotton-picking idea what grade our kids are in. Okay, so don't ask, please. Why? Because when Emily takes her math class, Emily is not getting it at all, at all, at all. We left Saxon in the dust. We got the little manipulative Matthew C. thing where you're doing the blocky things, and she just looked at them and started chewing on them, and that didn't really help too much. And then after that, we did the calculators for another year or two where you just go one, see a one, see a one, put a two. It doesn't matter what it means. Just keep doing it. You know. And then one day, Emily just got it. Out of the blue, Emily gets it. No idea how she gets it, but she gets it. And she takes off. And I learned that day that people do not learn on one nice little curve as established by the centralized standardized systems that will centralize and standardize all 6 million sheeple in America. And we're just going to go ahead and put that line in there. And if it will have two other lines too. Well, the little dummy dumb line will have the line that's the smarty pants line. And you put, you know, smarty pants up there and put the dummy dumbs down below. Everything will be a hunky-dory. No, no, no. Kids don't learn that way at all. Kids learn like this. You know, I just one learn like this, another learn like this, learn like this, learn like this, and another person don't learn anything for like 15 years, and they get it in like 3 weeks. And you're laughing, but you shouldn't be laughing. Or like Becca Joy, my 15-year-old was doing just fine until she was 15 years old, and then Brenda came back to me one day and says she forgot everything she's ever learned about math. I said, okay, let's just start all over again. You know, we'll just go all the way back to the beginning and start over. No big deal. Then she got this second time through a little quicker than the first, and that's good. That's the way they learn. And people ask me, what do I do with a little boy? He's got ADD, ABD, American boy disease, and all the other boy diseases that are ruining boys everywhere. The answer is very, very simple. There's a war against boys going on, by the way, and there's a reason 80% of them are not grown up, and 61% or 83% of them are incapable of providing for households in the millennial generation. There's a reason for all of that, okay? And one of the big reasons is they're in the box. that has been set by law again and again, and we fought this battle, the compulsory attendance law battles in our state again and again. We have exempted homeschoolers only. The private schoolers, Christian schoolers, and public schooler parents care less. Care less about it. I care. I fought tooth and nail for even the private and Christian schools and the public schools, but I didn't win. But I won it for the homeschoolers and those meetings. This little bit of liberty we're carving out, especially for boys, because some boys don't belong bolted to a chair for 7 hour a day from the time they're 5 years old. Do you understand me here? There's nothing in the Bible about that. Again, you show me in this book where a boy has to be put to a chair, bolted to that chair. Louis L'Amour, amazing. Amazing. At 12 years of age, he left school for the last time. And he became, of course, the most popular novelist, according to the Guinness Book of World Records, sold more novels than anybody else in the history of the world. And I can give you many other examples, Patrick Henry, others, who make it out of the box. But you know what? Some boys don't belong bolted to that chair. So if you got ABD, ADD, what do you do? I tell parents, and I'm honest about this, you don't bolt that kid to that chair. You let him work with dad in the fields from the time he's 5 or 6 or 7 years of age. Let him work with his hands. I know a sheep rancher tells me, boys got to work with their hands. This guy's got 40,000 sheep up in Fort Collins, Colorado. Boys have to be working with their hands. This guy's like 6'10", and he's got hands that are like a foot long. And he just says, you got to work with their hands. And we'll let him do some books, But here's the deal. Let mom read to him out loud for 5, 6 years till he's 12 or 13 years of age. Whatever you do, don't give him kindergarten or give him TV or anything of that. But by the time he's 13 or 14, you come back and we'll talk about whether he needs to learn how to read right now. You say, oh no, that's awful. I can't believe the speaker at this homeschooling conference actually said that you don't have to teach a kid to read till he's 12 or 13 if he's not ready to read. I can't believe somebody said that. I say it because God's word backs me up. It's the standard of law and liberty. And you do not have to follow the school district. I release you from that. God releases you from that. Some boys do not need to be tyrannized from the time they're 5 or 6 years of age. However, they do need to learn hard work and how to honor mother and father. That's the book of Proverbs. That's the standard. They can learn it by factoring trinomials and reading Plato by the time they're 12, or they can learn it by plowing the fields next to dad. It's your call. Parents, it's your call. You say, I'm responsible to make some of these decisions, and they're very unique for each one of my kids. That's right. God bless you and God give you wisdom. You're not going to get it from the experts. Here's what's happening, friends. Standardization, centralization, killing education. I can move on to the principle of relationships. Principle of relationships, key, absolutely key. Very important, very central in the education of children. Because in the book of Proverbs, chapter 23, the very heart of it, the father cries out, my son, give me your heart. Come close, observe my ways. I never had a university professor stand up and say, my son, give me your heart. Come close, observe my ways. I never had a chemistry professor do that to me. Why? Because relationships are worthless. My advisor at my university, I said, I'd like to visit with you on a weekly basis. He says, no. If I had things my way, I'd sit here and contemplate my navel all day, come back in 4 years. It wasn't super relational, if you know what I'm saying. Most teaching is not. Most teachers have been taught by non-relational seminary professors and university professors. That's why pastors aren't relational. Because the whole system is anti-relational. And here's why. Here's why. Because you get a different teacher every year and every hour in junior high and high school. Why? Because they are all about efficiency, standardization, centralization, big power systems where you specialize and specialize and specialize and specialize. And God says, no, I'm about relationships. I'm about relationships. It's relationships that matter to me. But specialization and centralization trumps relationship in modern education. And most homeschooling parents don't get it. By the time their kids are in high school or college, they forget about it. Forget the whole relational thing. Forget the discipleship thing. Forget the mentorship thing. Forget everything these speakers have ever taught us. We don't want a paradigm shift in the way we educate our children. Relationships matter to God. Why? Because He's Trinitarian. He's Trinitarian. Unitarians create boring, large, derelationalized institutions. That's what they did. That's the difference between the 1800s and 1900s. That's the difference. Relationships matter. Let me give you an example. There was a family up in Northwest Oregon, and my dad sent me this story. He emails me like 7-8 times a day with all kinds of ideas. And this family went out to the woods 4 years earlier. And it was just a father and daughter. And he was freaking out about the inner city stuff, and they're poor, and he didn't want to send his kids to the public schools because there's way too much illicit sex and drugs and all the rest. So, I mean, dad just took off, went to the woods, lived there for 4 years. Okay? Well, they're out there for 4 years. The police find them, this national forest. They have this creek running by. They've got food. They got a few things, a few books. You can see the World Book set of encyclopedias and a dictionary. Well, that's what they had. So the girl is 12 years old, and by and large, she's well-fed. She seems pretty well-adjusted. They've been to town, I think, from time to time to go to church. There's a few things going on in the midst, but they lived out there. And the police were concerned, so they gave this girl a standardized test. At 12 years of age, they'd been there for 4 years, she tested out as a 12th grade high school graduate. And this just blew them away. They could not believe that this had happened, because you know what? All they had was a World Book set of encyclopedias and a Bible. It's pretty much all they had for their curriculum. And she was doing really, really well. I mean, she was a 12th grade high school graduate, 12 years of age. Police couldn't believe it. We were at a homeschooling conference where we had, 500 vendors or whatever. My wife came out right when the story broke. She came out of the vendor hall and she said, "Oh, man, every single vendor says if you don't buy my stuff, you're going to give your kid a substandard education. What do we do? Should we buy all of it, hon?" You know, one of those moments. And I had just heard the story, and I came back to my wife, and I said, "Here, honey, here's what you do. Blindfold me. Just blindfold me, okay? Give me a blindfold here, and I will walk randomly through the vendor hall and just grab, like, seven things, and we'll use that." It's not about professional curriculum. It's not about $10 billion. It's not about you getting money from the state because you can't afford a $5 World Book Encyclopedia set at a garage sale, okay? You say, what is it about? As it turns out, now take a look at what Police Sergeant Barkley said about the investigation. Hit that key one more time and let's take a look at this quote. What he said was, "It was amazing how unsuitable their circumstances were, but how wonderful their relationships were." It should be on the screen right now. It's not. But how wonderful their relationships were. See, there was a connection between that father and that daughter. Turns out that a father that loves his daughter, a father that knows his daughter, a father that's willing to walk beside, a father that's willing to spend the time, develop the relationship. See, again, the professionals come back and they say, can it be that easy? Could it be that relationships trump the professional degrees? Why is it that there is no statistically significant difference whatsoever in the performance of the kids whose parents are teacher certified versus those that are not? There has to be an explanation for it. It has to do with the fact that these kids are working with their parents, and there's nobody that knows them as well as the parents do, nobody who loves them as well as the parents do. And it turns out the relationships, the knowledge, the love, that the care that parents put in is enough to trump everything else, all the other factors. I could give you so many others. I know I'm clean out of time. Life integration. We got to life apply. Got to life apply. So much education is cerebral. You sit in classrooms. You don't get up and do stuff. You sit in a classroom as designed by the Greeks, and you don't go out and do anything. My wife shot up one night, and she said, "Whoa, Emily forgot to do her grammar today. It's 11 o'clock at night and she's been in bed for an hour. So what are we going to do?" I said, "Let's get her out of bed so she'll do her grammar." Boom. But you know what? We stopped and we said, no, that's not going to work. Because she was asleep and we didn't want to bother her sleep. But I asked my wife, what was Emily doing all day if she wasn't doing her grammar? And my wife thought for a moment. She said, Emily was writing a letter to grandma. And she was 9 years old, and she was writing 2 pages typewritten letters to grandma and explaining what was going on in the home. It was amazing, everything she was explaining. And then as I was thinking about all this letter writing that Emily had been doing, I said to myself, why do we do grammar? Does anybody know why we do grammar? We do so much of it, year in, year out, year in, year out. Is it so that when you're 26 years of age, you get out of bed and you say, it's time to do more grammar. I prepared all my life to do more grammar. Grammar time. No. This is a huge revelation. Everybody ready? Ready? The reason why you do grammar is so that you can write letters to grandma. It's just that there is such a disconnect between the sterile classroom where nothing happens. Nothing. It's not life. It's not grandma. It's not work. It's not politics. It's not church. It's nothing. It's an island. And by the method of education we have imposed on billions of people around the globe, we have lost the life integration element, which is extremely powerful. Extremely powerful. I think if we maximize on this, we will prepare our children to be some of the most life-relevant, inventive, productive, successful children the world has ever known. And I believe that from the bottom of my heart. You got to read my book, Upgrade, to really get to the heart of life integration. Life integration totally ignored by the Greeks. Not important for the most part. Okay, now here's the last point. Last point. I know I've told you all these things. What's a good education? How do we get a good education? What does the Bible say? James speaks about life versus knowledge. You've got to apply, otherwise you never knew it. All these principles come from the Bible. Character preeminent, education of a child. I mean, it's preeminent. It throws through. Individuality essential. It's liberating. Take the numbers off the books and just do some stuff and work with your children individually. It's beautiful. It's a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful vision that just is not replicated by 95% education. It's a paradigm shift, I know. Not very many people will get it. But life integration, wonderful if we could ever develop science that was life integrated. There's almost none of it out there. None of it out there. It's boring, boring 2D stuff. It's terrible. Most science is terrible. It needs to be completely redone. Okay, but life integration, wonderful, powerful, incredibly powerful. I've given you relationships, the very heart of education. But here's the most important. The beginning of knowledge is the fear of God. Proverbs 1:7. It's the most important, the most basic. Whatever you do, you've got to teach the fear of God as the beginning of wisdom and knowledge. That's the most important. So if you walk away from here and you didn't get anything else, you were asleep for the first 55 minutes, you've got to leave here understanding that the fear of God has to be shot through it all. I mean the literature. I mean, that's one reason why I wrote Apostate the way I did and criticized Mark Twain, Nathaniel Hawthorne, Shakespeare. And people are horrified by what I've done. But I take him and I contrast him with the true and living God and their words. And I encourage the fear of God in the literature classroom. I mean fear. I mean fear of God in literature classroom. And without the fear of God in literature classrooms, in Wheaton College, because they separated God's word, God's law, from Mark Twain, Nathaniel Hawthorne, and Shakespeare. They do not fear God. They do not fear God, and the majority of Wheaton College professors vote for Barack Obama. Okay? So fear of God is essential. It's almost non-existent in most American Christian education, Christian home education, Christian college. Almost non-existent. You rarely hear of men, Christian men in Christian colleges, trembling in the Christian in the chemistry laboratories. Trembling. I mean, shaking. And falling down on their knees and raising their hands and saying, right in the middle of it, I'm not talking about chapel time. The nice little segregated chapel time. No, 100 no's. I'm talking about the chemistry classroom, the laboratory, where men are shaking as they view the creation itself and then realize they have come face to face with the fingerprints of the Creator God Himself. This kind of thing hardly ever happens in American higher education. And for this reason, we are impoverished. And every one of our institutions is practically godless. This is the core. This is the core. This is the very core of the great war of the worldviews. What in the world am I talking about? Am I talking about education? All this time I'm talking about the things that are vitally important, absolutely essential, the very, very core elements that have to be in a Christian theory of education. I've talked about individuality, character, life integration, walking beside, talking beside, relationship, life integration, and the fear of God. Friends, almost without exception, ignored by American typical classrooms as not very important as principles, not taught in your American Christian college, teaching colleges. They're just not taught. They're ignored. Why? Because we haven't been talking about education. We're talking about discipleship. Do you remember the expert that said unqualified persons should not perform brain surgery? As some reflection on that, I've come to the conclusion that I agree with him. Unqualified persons should not perform brain surgery. I agree. But here's the issue. In education, we're not performing brain surgery. We're performing heart surgery. And nobody's qualified for that. I will tell you from the bottom of my heart, as I focus on character and life integration and the relational discipleship, I'm doing heart surgery. As I'm teaching my son to factor trinomials, I'm doing heart surgery. And nobody's qualified for that. And that's why my wife stresses out at 11:30 at night. My little girl, Abigail, is the sweetest girl in the whole world. I don't know why God gave us the sweetest girl in the whole world, but he did. When she was four years old, she says, "Daddy, I want to learn to ride a bike. And this year, I want to learn to read God's Word." So she learned to read God's Word. And she learned to write a little bit. So the next Father's Day, she writes me a little card. "Dear Daddy, I love you. Love, Abigail." And she misspelled daddy and love. And she tied to this little card a candy cane that was busted in like six places. And it had been chewed on both sides. I mean, it was in pretty poor shape. But she had taped the whole thing up. And she gave this to me. I recognized it because I had given it to her last Christmas. You know, it was one of those deals. So, but that was what she had. So she gave that to me. What do you think I responded? You think I said, "Honey, someone's been chewing on this. I can't eat this. I mean, what is this, some kind of a gift?" You think that's the way I responded to her? No. My sweet girl, I put her in my lap. I hugged her. And hugged her. Again, sweetest girl in the world. I said, "Honey, you did this for me. Thank you so much. I love you, honey. Oh, you're so sweet. Thank you. This is a gift from you to me. I love you so much." And friends, on your very best day, homeschooling/home discipling your children, the very best day you've ever had, you've had a lot of bad days, finally you get a good day, you run up to God and you say, "God, here you go." And you trip and you fall and you get a little mud on the candy cane. That's okay. And you come up to him and you say, "God, thank you so much." And you say, "I love you. Here's what I did for you today." And God takes you in his lap. And God says, "What? You did this for me? Thank you. You are such a blessing. I love you. I love you. I love you." And you know what? He knows, and you know, that you're not giving him something that he didn't give to you last Christmas. Do you get it? Does anybody get it? Two. Does anybody else get it? I know it's not Dewey. I know it's not humanist classical education. I know it involves relationship. I know the vertical is a reflection of the horizontal. Do you get it? Do you really get it? Very few do. I hope you do. Thank you.